Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and have a great day.
Okay, this is a speaker meeting. Kathy will speak for 10 minutes and then turn the meeting over to our main speaker, Armando, who will share his experience, strength, and hope.
Hi, my name is Kathy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Kathy.
I will stand up. I am short, I know. And even if you're tall, you still probably need to stand up. I have been in the program since October 4th, 2003. I have to think about it because I get the 4 and the 3 mixed up. It'll be 12 years in October, so 11 years and 10 months or so. For a little 10-minute spiel, that's probably just about long enough for my story, because I always say I don't have really a spellbinding drunkalog. I, for whatever reason, I'm one of those people that did not have to get a DUI, did not have to lose a job, did not lose my kids, did not lose my marriage, but I had a desire to stop drinking. What happened to me is, like many of us, this is a hereditary disease in my family. And my dad kind of went downhill after he divorced my mom. He married a woman who was a raging alcoholic, I would say. And he finally had a drinking buddy. And he went downhill for about 12 years. And he died. And went in the hospital, had a minor heart attack, and the doctor came out when he was putting a stent in and said, "Does he drink?" And his wife, my stepmother, said, "No." And he said, "Well, he's lying to you then, because he's in the middle of the DTs." And he had gone into the DTs because he'd been in the hospital for 3 days while they waited to do the procedure. They moved him from one hospital to another, and he went into the DTs. And he was in the hospital for a couple days, and then he came home for a day and had a massive heart attack and died at age 61. Mm. And so for whatever reason, that kind of is what keeps me in here. I stopped drinking for 6 months immediately right then because I thought, I drink, and I have a personality very similar to his. There's a lot about us that's the same, and I am drinking just like he did 20 years ago. So the writing's on the wall. Why don't I just stop? So I stopped, but I didn't go to AA. And you know how that turned out. So a couple months later, I decided I would reframe things and say, it's okay. I can just be moderate. I'm not going to be like him. And so I proceeded to continue to drink. And 18 months later, I finally decided I'm ending up by myself drinking alone. By this time, I'd gone through a divorce, so I truly was alone, and this is not how I want to live my life, and I don't want to end up like him. So I went to AA, and even then, that wasn't quite enough. I had to do some more research. I stayed in for 8 months, and then I thought, I got this. I can handle this. This is great for you people. It's overkill for me. So I have things to do. I don't have time for these meetings. I am very busy. And so I went out and did more research. And I just couldn't control it. I just could not stop drinking. I would go out and drink, and yet I'd be afraid to act like the other drunks at the bar because they were stupid. And really, you know, I did not want to act like that. So I would drink as much as I could to drive, be very careful when I'm driving, and then buy more alcohol on the way home and drink at home. And At some point, I just thought, this is the same thing I was doing before, and I went back into the program, and then I was more willing. And I, does somebody have a timer? I didn't, is anybody, are you watching?
I'm timing.
Okay. I found a woman who I thought was really mean, and I asked her to be my sponsor, because I thought, anybody else, I'm going to walk all over and tell them I don't need this, and she pretty much told me I did need it. And it stuck. You know, it stuck. And what really has helped me in this last period of time is to stop wondering whether I should be here or not, you know, because I hear stories and I think, oh, I didn't do that. I didn't do that. And I'm not like that. And I'm not that crazy. And I'm sort of crazy, but I'm not that crazy. And what ended up happening is that I just kind of surrendered. And I found my higher power in here. And I had been to church. I had read self-help books. I had done all those things to try to find, you know, to fill up that hole inside me. And nothing quite did it for me except sitting in a room and being and hurting in some way and then hearing exactly what I needed to hear from the other people in the room when they shared. And that was my higher power. And so I started coming to the rooms and bringing my problems to the rooms. I brought my work problems, a lot of work problems over the years, because I kind of that's kind of my laboratory. A lot of relationships at work that I have to deal with. And I used to say that AA gave me sort of life 101, like a manual on how to deal with life, because what I learned at home doesn't really work. And so what has happened is that I now have a toolkit that I can learn how to deal with life. What has also happened is I've started to pray and meditate. I try to pray. I say try, and I really do mean try because it is not perfect. But I have meditation books. I do that on a daily basis to try to maintain some conscious contact with God. And I've started meditating, which I never could really do. And I'm still early stages, but I found an app on my phone that, for whatever reason, made it seem simple, and I've been doing it for about a month. So I'm really kind of hopeful for what that holds. And, you know, that's what keeps me coming back, is really how to deal with life. So thank you.
Thank you.
So now I turn it over to Armando.
Okay, can I get a 10-minute thing
yeah.
so I make sure that I get to sober? Okay, so I'm looking around. I'm Armando. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Armando.
And with the possible exception of Chelsea or Robert, I don't think I know you guys or you know my story. And it's been a long time since I've got to share, you know, for 40 minutes. I haven't been to this meeting, well, for a few years, so it was at the other place. And my sobriety date is July 10th, 1989, which is totally arbitrary because I was that first year, I was not sober. I was not drinking. I was not using, but I was just so toxic. When Guillermo asked me to speak, he said I could pick the day. So I picked today. August 29th is my belly button birthday. So I'm 64 years old today. I got an e-card today telling me yes to all the Beatles questions on that song, if you ever heard it, when I'm 64. I woke up this morning sleeping for the first time in a week and no sleep for 2 days because I don't do well in the heat. So it felt really good, but they were saying it was the 10th anniversary of Katrina. And I remember 10 years ago, I would have been 16 years sober, and I was talking to a group of people in my day job in, I think, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Hurricane Katrina was just hitting New Orleans then, and I was speaking to them and facilitating as one of the leaders of this thing, and telling them I was in exactly the right place. It's what I wanted to do, sharing on my birthday, because I wanted to be of service. And, of course, that's because that's what I learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. So what it was like what happened and what it's like now. So I know Kate over at the Rockridge Fellowship remembers, like, the first time I shared there that I remember when I moved up here from Santa Barbara, where I spent, like, 30 years from 70 to 2000, that I grew up learning Spanish and English. English was kind of funky because my dad learned English from watching, reading comic books and watching TV shows. So there were lots of kapows and bangs and stuff like that, which made it strange at school. So much of my story, I was never homeless. I just didn't have a place to live, and in Santa Barbara it doesn't rain, so what's the problem? I wasn't a juvenile delinquent, but in third grade, I organized some kids, and we beat up the sixth graders and took over the playground. Today, I say that my chooser's broken. I don't know whether I'm hot or cold, whether I'm mad, angry, in love, or whatever. I just don't. And I don't worry about it, and coming to Alcoholics Anonymous has made me be okay with that. So part of what made me who I am, or the kind of alcoholic that I am from the very beginning, my mom was 15 when she married my dad, who was 17. They were born here but raised in Mexico, and she was a juvenile delinquent, I hear from, you know, my grandfather, and dropped out of junior high school at that time. And when I was made it through elementary school and in junior high school, she decided to go back to school and get a GED and then go to college and do all that stuff. And the whole time that I was growing up, you know, I bought all the bullshit. She said, you can grow up and be president of the United States, you know, this wonderful country and that kind of stuff. And I believed it. I mean, I just did. But that was sort of aside this psychotic thing, because she'd be in school. I remember one time my dad made in the backyard a pile of her books and set them on fire, a bonfire. So there was weird stuff going on throughout me growing up. Because, I blame my mom, the president thing, I was always running and president of everything and student body president and all that stuff. And along the way, about in high school, my dad started doing a number on me. And I've since made peace with him. He passed away a few years ago, and I held him as he was fighting his demons and said it was okay. But he would always say, they're not going to elect you. They make fun of you because you're a Mexican. And then when I'd win, he'd say, they only elected you so they could make fun of you behind your back. So it was kind of a mindfuck thing. And I was, you know, part of, I think, my chooser being messed up is stuff. If I was a psychologist and psychoanalyzing people, I would know exactly what's wrong with me and what the buttons are and why I push. But, you know, being inside this body, I just know it was all very, very confusing. Okay, so I'm student body president in 1969, and there's this thing called the war in Vietnam. And, you know, the main difference between that and the war y'all are living through, wars we're living through now, is that our friends were going and getting killed. And on the nightly news, we'd watch their coffins, and there'd be lines of coffins, and they'd be coming home. They don't do that anymore. But we were pissed off, and me and the other five student body presidents in Long Beach, California, shut down the school system, and we held what we called a convocation. We didn't know what the fuck we were doing, but we just wanted to protest. And because of that, the government overreacted, which they are wont to do, think Ferguson. We were a mixed-race community in Long Beach. Pauley was all black. Millikan and Lakewood were white, but we were all talking together, and the powers at DB didn't like that, and so a bunch of really weird stuff happened that I won't go into except to say that I dropped out of school, but nobody knew because I was still thought to be a good kid. I went to live in a gas station and just pumped gas. I didn't want to think about anything. So when it came time for graduation, people found out I wasn't going to Harvard because I didn't bother to apply. I ended up, this is the story of my life. I have had so many blessings, God shots, that I paid no attention to. And I'll do a few of them for you. The first one was people pull strings, and I got into like five colleges, USC, UCLA, I think Berkeley, and Santa Barbara, and someplace else. And I said, I want to go to UC Santa Barbara because it was a party school. Now, I'm totally antisocial. I don't give a shit about parties. But it was the farthest thing from politics that I could imagine, right, go to a party school. So I got on my little Kawasaki 90, rode up the freeway, got there, and all hell broke loose. The party school turned into something else. Me and a bunch of guys burned down the Bank of America. An incident happened, and a student was killed. It was like the best of times, worst of times. Now, in line with the God shots, I was one night, and I've written about this, lying in the tall grass next to the stop and go. They don't have stop and goes now, right? It's like 7-Eleven, one of those kind of things. And the National Guard came in with bayonets, and they were doing that to the grass. That same meeting in Rockridge, when it was on Broadway, when I was telling just a little bit of my story at the 6:15 meeting, Bobby, Lord Orange, came up to me after the meeting and said he was one of those National Guardsmen that did that. He remembered it. Bobby's passed on since then, but just another God shot. In Carpinteria, where I spend half my time now, and we'll get to that when I get sober, there's a famous picture, you can Google it, of a police lieutenant with a mace, so the stick with the ball and chain with the spikes in it, because there was lots of posturing back in this time. He was in charge of the tanks and the troops that came in and did that stuff. Well, I'm not telling his name, but you can figure it out. But I met him in sobriety about 10 years ago in Carpinteria at a meeting, men's meeting. And we hugged and laughed and cried about, you know, the best of times and worst of times. But he was sober about 20 years at that point. What happened to me was I got picked out. I was a student leader. And so 300 of us got arrested, and they let everybody out but me. And they did a number on me, and what I figured out since was I had a nervous breakdown because they beat the shit out of me. They had CRC bulls, correctional officers that told everybody I was dead. So that was like probably the first of becoming a real alcoholic. So since then, after that, you know, it was, like you might imagine, they wanted to do a TV show on me and all that stuff, and I couldn't handle anything. And so that was one of the first times I left the country. And the reason I left the country was because the FBI raided my mom's house and my poor little skinny brother with guns drawn because they had shoot-to-kill orders on me. Like I said, stuff was just really overreaction time like that. So as if, you know, that's not enough to drive you to drink, it did me. But I didn't really, when I was a few years sober, I remember the switch. I remember when I can say I became an alcoholic. And that was in 1976 when I was with a bunch of other long-haireds driving to Peru, because that's where the cocaine is, right? So that's why you go there. And we took a detour through Mexico in a Volkswagen minibus and ended up in Belize, which was great, except that we got arrested for smuggling cocaine, which, I mean, I'd tell you if I had it, but we didn't, you know, we didn't. What had happened, though, was they just recently, they used to be British Honduras, and they just got their independence. So the guy, the constable, this big Idi Amin type dude, wanted to make a statement. And so my friend even sent me, I've still got him, the newspaper clippings, the Bandidos Americanos, who had figured out how to mix cocaine with soap. Because what they had pulled out, I laughed at them because they said, that's soap powder. You know, we wash clothes with that. And so they figured that was a conspiracy and that what we were doing was smuggling cocaine and so forth. I mean, it was hysterical. And it would have been funny. And it was kind of funny, except the jails in Belize are not fun. They actually were kind of waiting to get us to lock us up away forever, and so they didn't actually torture us, but they did the Belizeans in the cells with us, so it was really not pretty. That was, you know, a notch towards full-blown alcoholism. Our solicitor, who didn't believe we were... by the way, they do the English system when you're in court, so you're in a box over here. Everybody wears wigs, and your lawyers, solicitors are over there, and it's just weird. But we got out on bail, and we went out to the K's, and that's when I remember at Rick's Bar, because there's always a Rick's Bar, right, wherever you are. Johnny Walker Red, I wanted to just go away. You know, I just drank because I knew that they were going to lock me up forever and ever and ever. And they would have, too, if there hadn't been another series of amazing stories. And, you know, I've since had my friends who were there corroborated because I can't even believe this shit. I just know I was really lucky, and we made it out of Belize, and I'm grateful. I made it back to the United States. The University of California repatriated me. Again, God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And all I can remember is sitting with the vice chancellor in his car overlooking the student USEN at Santa Barbara. If you go there, there's a lagoon there. It's pretty. It's beautiful. And all I could think of was, when's this fucker going to let me go so that I can go get some, at that point, MDA? Which, there is a lawyer who goes to a Vision for You. He's about... 10 years younger than me, and at 13 years of age, he was my dealer, and I didn't know that. But he pointed that out when he heard this piece of my story. But Vice Chancellor George Smith was trying to tell me that this was a second chance that I got and that I should make good on it, and I paid no attention to him whatsoever at all. Just thought, let me get the fuck out of here. And... eventually I did, and then a whole bunch of other drunkalog kind of stuff happened. So this is all in Santa Barbara. Early 1989, a friend who I was a movie producer, it's another part of my story, and she was one of the people that I talked out of all of her money to invest in movies and stuff in Hollywood. And she came by to visit. I stopped being a Hollywood producer because I spent too much time in the emergency room in Hollywood, ODing, and with seizures. And so I just couldn't do it anymore. But she was sober. And I remember I just thought that was insane. I mean, she was a heroin addict, for Christ's sakes, you know. But all she said was that she was sober. So I swore... in the first 5 years of my sobriety. So I got sober in 89, you know, the blessings in the program. We bought a house in Santa Barbara in like 95. And up until that time, I swore that, God, if I'd only known about AA, I would have come sooner, you know. So I'm moving out the garage, and there's a big filing cabinet there because I'm anal. Save everything, and I start to take the drawers out, and the top drawer, there's a frickin' file in there that says AA. And I've got all this literature that I gathered about Alcoholics Anonymous. To this day, I don't remember when or how that happened. But that year, in 1989, after Chris came by, I decided that I was going to get sober. Macho man, right? And so I stopped drinking, and it was no fun. But this time I was drinking Palmesan Vin Rosé Sec, because that's all I could afford. And years later, a neighbor, our windows faced each other, said, yeah, she could always hear around 3 or 4 o'clock the pop of the bottle coming off. You know. So I was being a martyr, and my good Al-Anon wife said, you should go to the doctor. And I went, no, I can do it. She goes, no, maybe they can give you something to help you. And I thought, aha. Drugs. So I went and I met this doctor for the first time, Dr. Van Hamilton in Santa Barbara. And I told him my story and everything. And so I asked him for some Valium or at least some codeine or, you know, something to taper off. And he said, no, I'm not going to do that. And then he asked me if I'd ever consider AA. And I said, no, not really. And for some reason, he said, well, I'm not going to give you anything, but you should go to an AA meeting. That's my prescription for you. And I said, okay, and I have no earthly idea. The only thing I can figure is that I believed if I said I'd go, he'd give me drugs. It's the only thing that made sense to me. So I went home. I called central office. Gertrude answered the phone. She's about 150 years old. And she said, yes, dear. And I said, I need to go to a meeting. And she said, oh, yes, dear. And so I did not talk to this woman very much at all, right? But I swear to God, the way it went was she said, well, we have a nice meeting tonight, and she gave me the address. And I said, okay. And I was thinking, and Santa Barbara's not that big a place. And I said, that's a church. She goes, yes, dear. And I said, does it have to be a church? And she paused, and then she said, yes, dear, I think for you it has to be. You know. So I go to this meeting, and there is absolutely nothing right with this place. It's bright white, you know. The lights are glaring, the church is all white, the people are all white. You know, it's like, I was just cringing. And but I sat through it. I'm sure I was drunk. And in Santa Barbara, one thing that I really miss is at the time, I thought it was just absolutely weird. They have birthdays. When you have a birthday, everybody sings happy birthday. Sounds terrible, as you might imagine. And you get a cake, and someone gives you a chip. And I still have a chip, and I still carry extra chips. And whenever I'm at the right place, I pass along chips to people because that's just really cool. If anyone's ever done that to you, it's very cool. And so the first person went up, and it was like, you know, just embarrassing, the singing. And then they talked, said a bunch of bullshit. And then this guy went up. And, you know, to this day, I don't know him. I know who he is, though, and I can see him. And they sang happy birthday, and he had a year chip, and he stood in front of this church, this little white guy, and everybody was stupid grins on their face like you guys have, you know, like we do. And it was quiet. And the guy was just, you know, doing this kind of stuff. And like I'd always done all my life, I thought, what a bunch of assholes, you know. Jesus Christ, look at this guy. He's dying up there. Why didn't somebody do something? I'll do something. You know, I went through all of that brilliant thinking, brilliant alcoholic thinking. And I have no idea how long he was up there. But like a ton of bricks, that moment of clarity that it talks about in the big book, I realized that he didn't have to say anything, you know, that it was okay just to be. And that was my moment of clarity. You know, I wanted to be someplace where I didn't have to have the answers, where I didn't have to, you know, say anything, where I could just be okay. I knew that, and, you know, viscerally, I knew that that's what I wanted. I didn't think it had anything to do with drinking. So I didn't go back to that meeting. But the next day I found the Alano Club, which it was just weird. Y'all been to Alano Clubs? You know, I mean, I did not get the concept. Go to the Alano Club. It's for alcoholics. You get there and there's a big sign that says absolutely no drinking. It's like, okay, what's wrong with this picture? Why would there be a sign that says no drinking for alcoholics? I mean, it made absolutely no sense to me. But what I heard, you know, what got through to my pea brain, I remembered it being okay to just be. And that's what I was there. I found the seriously sick table. I'm sure some of you have sat there for months, years, or whatever. I found my first sponsor there. My higher power was Barry, the cross-addicted garbage can homeless man. He took advantage of me. He always asked me for money, and I gave it to him because I thought it was a spiritual concept. That's fine. That's fine. That was fine. My first sponsor was Ron C. He was a disbarred, long-haired lawyer, biker, survivor of the Jonestown Massacre. And that's who I was, and that's who I needed. I was at a meeting earlier today to try to get a little spiritual before coming here, and a bunch of newcomers. And they were saying, one after the other, I hope I get some time so that I can carry the message. And the truth is, you know, one alcoholic to another, time means nothing. That's my experience. If you're not had a drink, you can talk to another alcoholic. So I stayed sober. I honestly didn't believe people were not drinking. I didn't. More blessings happened to me. I immediately got hired for the Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse as a writer. I should have mentioned that. So after being a movie producer, I was a writer, and I chickened out of doing that because of my experience with being a producer. And there's some marriage reasons stuff, Al-Anon kind of stuff in there. But anyway, but I was a known writer, so I got hired by the Council on Alcoholism. And you know what terrified me? Another Godshot thing. So we started the first drug court in, not drug court, what do you call it? Detox. Acupuncture? I'm losing it what it is. Acupuncture Detox Drug Court, yeah, in California. It started in Dade County in Florida with, at that time, Attorney General Janet Reno. Before she was Attorney General, she was there, and she, in Florida, she started it. So we were starting it, so the Attorney General was coming. My title, if you ever get this title run, was Director of Special Projects. That means you do everything, make everything work. And so I was coordinating this visit. So this was like, I'd just gotten sober. This was in 1989, and I realized the jig was up. Because I found out that Janet Reno is the only one besides the president and vice president who has a Secret Service detail, because in the order of command, they fall underneath her. So they had to do a background check on me. So what the fuck? You know, I have a colorful history. You've heard a little bit about it. I practice the principles as best I can in this program, do the footwork. And I swear to God, the day the Attorney General of the United States was there, the Secret Service guy came up to me, and I like to think he put his arm around me. He didn't, but he did say, "We checked you out, Armando, and you could come work for us." So it's another God shot, you know, God doing for me what I could not do. Now, how that happens, I don't know. But, you know, I see those all the time. My sponsor's Michael L. His home group is the Pacoima group. If you've ever been to Pacoima, you know, the secretary there is someone who used to be on death row. How do you do that? How do you get off death row, you know? It's the miracles happen in this program. How much time have I got left?
15 minutes.
15? Okay, so I got sober. And it was a blur working for the Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. I sort of have my employment history is in 6-year increments. And this last job, which I've been at 6 years, I was going to try to break that. I always used to say, because it was true, that I've been fired from every job I've ever had. But what happened about a dozen years ago is when you get to a certain level, you don't get fired. You know, you get bought off, essentially, but I'm a CEO type guy, and so that's what happens. It's no harm, no foul. I like to think it's like, it's like Donald Trump, right? Or the guy that ran for president last year. You're just the biggest bastard around, and that's celebrated in this country. So I like to think that I'm not being a bastard, but I go the other direction. I try to practice these principles in all the business affairs, which doesn't work good with corporate America. But it works really well with the organizations that I've had the honor to lead. And I've done a bunch of them. The Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment, the Environmental Defense Center, Redefining Progress, the think tank of economists. I've been blessed to get these incredible gigs to do what I always wanted to do, which is just save the world. Remember my mother? You can be president of the United States. I don't know any other way. I don't know what I would do if I got out of bed and I wasn't trying to make it so that, you know, for one day, black people can walk around without being afraid of getting shot in this fucking country. You know, so that women don't, 95% of the time, when a couple says, "Let's talk about where we live and we'll do what's best for us," they always do what the man wants. You know, just again and again and again. This is what sobriety does for you, folks. You get to see what's real. You know, the big lesson I got in early sobriety that I paid attention to in Santa Barbara was a speaker who said, "The letters sober stand for son of a bitch, everything's real." So, you know, whatever the reasons for the disease. Alcohol, I know, saved me from going stark raving mad for a dozen, 20 years. And then when it didn't, thank God that Alcoholics Anonymous was there. So I've had a really good run at doing work. To this day, I still anchor a conversation Monday at noon that takes place in Washington, D.C. That's a watchdog group of 250 organizations from across the country checking up on Congress and pulling the covers on them. And I get to do that. And nobody pays us to do it, but it's just doing the right thing. But what happened to me most recently is I got a surprise, and it turns out I found out on March 31st, almost April Fool's Day, I'd just flown down to University at Northridge to do some presentations and classes and stuff, and I got a text from my doctor saying, "I'm so sorry to have to tell you this, but you have heart failure." It was like, wow, that seems pretty major. And thank God I was really busy at the university doing a bunch of stuff. You know, 24 hours, they had a dinner, they had a breakfast, they had a lunch, I taught a class, a bunch of stuff. So I really didn't think about it too much. But when I got back, I went to the doctor, and it turns out I've been having heart attacks since 2011. I knew I was feeling poorly, but I'm a fucking alcoholic, and I'm busy. You know, can't really take time out for a heart attack. And I just thought it was indigestion. So I'm learning to live with congestive heart failure. And the good news is you can live with it. 20 years ago, you died. That's what the doc says. You would see people two or three times, and then they're dead. The trick is, it's kind of like Alcoholics Anonymous. You got to do the stuff. You know, you got to take the medication. I had to change my diet. All that stuff. And then, you know, the $64,000 question, I have to limit stress in my life. So, yeah. So that has been a challenge. So I knew, and I still can't, you know, when I left Santa Barbara, the town had got too small, and kind of the Bay Area is kind of that way now, too. Shit, the country is too many people know me and call me and, you know, ask me to do stuff, because I've always done it, and I need to not do that. So what I did was, again, the blessings. I got back in touch with when I was a writer. And for the past 30 years, I've been on staff 1 week a month. I go to Santa Barbara, and I'm on staff at the Santa Barbara Writers Conference, and it's sort of like a checkout time for me, and I've done that for myself. So this time, I got in touch with them and told them what was going on, said I wanted to write, and it's like a whole other community. They took me in with open arms, and a couple of folks in here know that I get to spend a week. It's probably going to go up to 2 weeks a month. Anybody surf in here? Okay, so there's a house at Rincon Point that has the beach in front of it. It's the only one. That's where I get to go. And I get to hang out there and write and, you know, in touch with other writers in the writing community. And I know pretty much everybody now. And It's really a blessing, and it's a new lease on life for me. A couple of years ago, my sponsor said I had to stop doing service because I discovered service. Remember, I hid out when I got sober, and I didn't do service. I don't do fellowship. I don't do nothing. I'm basically really happy by myself. You know, my best day is lying in bed with the TV on, reading a book, and hopefully there's chocolate involved. But I really got into service here with the Rockridge Fellowship, and so I was a GSR and a DCM and a DCMC or whatever that is. And I did all group stay, and I did bunches of stuff, and so finally my sponsor said, stop it. Let other people do stuff. That time in my life is over. So I knew that coming into this, what the heart patients like to call the third trimester of life, living with heart disease, that I couldn't throw myself into AA, which was my first choice. I thought, oh, I'll just do that. Because like I said, I I don't know how not to do the saving the world stuff. I just don't know how not to do it. I honestly don't know what anybody does if they're not doing that. I don't get it. And you know, I know that's ingrained in me because, you know, my mom died being a do-gooder, and the world still sucks. You know, all the union organizers, all the good work, it sucks. You know, when the fuck are we going to get our act together? That's just how I'm wired. So I can write about it, and that's what I'm doing. And the other humongous challenge for mine in sobriety now, and I know this is going to seem like kindergarten to everybody in this room, is relationships. You know, I do not know. You know, if I don't know if it's hot or cold, if I'm angry or in love or anything like that, how the fuck do I relate to anybody? You know, I'm a good sponsor, right, Guillermo? Because I know how to do, give me a script and I'll do it. You know, I sponsor a bunch of people. There's stuff I know how to do, but one-on-one, how are you supposed to know? You know, I don't know. So that's the great journey that I'm in sobriety now on, right, is learning how to be. It's not being a worker among workers. I can do that. It's being one human being with another human being on the planet now. I am clueless, and I'm still a 12-year-old hurt little boy. So, you know, but I get to do that, right? 64 years old today, and it ain't over. You know, I get to learn new stuff, and that's incredible. I learn almost on a daily basis. I remember things. Like I said, there are people that have been, you know, in my life for a long time. There's the whole revolutionary people, and there's two or three people left alive because that stuff was real, and that's what happens. You die doing that stuff in not just this country. That's what happens. But I get to be alive. And so I'll remember something really insane, and it's true, and it happened. And it's always a lesson for me, for today, for something I can do to try to be of worth on the planet. I do the mumbo jumbo in the morning. I was sharing with somebody the other day, I hit my knees and pray every morning, but that's kind of cheating to say that because this is what I do. I read that part in the book, and I think it's still in there in the stories about the banner where the clergyman said, if you have a resentment for somebody, pray about it and it'll come true. So 20-some years ago, I started a resentment list. And if I know you, you're on it. and, you know, I don't know if good things are happening for people, but that's all I do. I figure it's like, I'm not Catholic, but what Catholics do with the rosary, you just say the mumbo jumbo. That's what I do. That's what I do. And it bleeds over. I thank God for having the people in my life because I know everyone's there for a reason. I just don't always know what the reason is. I also, some years ago, incorporated the third step prayer because I just really like it. And I'd like to do the St. Francis prayer, but there's too many versions of it. I can never figure out, make me an instrument, make me a channel, make me something of peace. I can't get it straight. I think in worldview, what's happening today, I'm in a good place, and it's taking me a really long time. I'm staying with the Conrads. Barnaby Conrad was like many things, a bullfighter, vice consul during the war, and spy, and he owned the El Matador in the day with Art Hoppe and those guys. And those are the people that have adopted me down in Carpinteria. But he tells a story of he was Sinclair Lewis's assistant. You know, he's also Joseph Conrad's nephew, so it's sort of like incestuous literary people. But anyway, he gave him, on his last day of work, 75 pages of a manuscript, The Matador, the book that sold 6 million copies, to read. And Sinclair read it, called him in, and said, you've really got something great here. Throw away the first 73 pages, and you've got something here. The reason I tell that story is because you honestly couldn't have told me when I was in my 20s or in my 30s that there was any value to years and experience on the planet. I literally have been, you know, at times sitting on a porch stoop with a 30-odd six ready to blow the next person away that walked up, because that's what we did back then. But, you know, what I've learned is that experience does count, and maybe it's just because I'm old now that I think that. But the blessings of it are, it turns out I have three novels I never published that I can publish. They're good. They were always good. And I'm writing this other one, and it's, you know, all these years when I mentored people and helped everybody with their writing, I was blown away to find out that you can graduate from college and not know how to write. I didn't know that. I, as you might imagine, when I split the country with shoot-to-kill orders, I dropped out of school. So I hadn't gone to college. But I know everybody. I mean, I know the editors, the publishers, the one. I know what good writing is. I know the project I'm working on right now is incredible. And so I get to do, once again, exactly what I want to do, right? I get to write. It's going to get published. People are going to read it. And that's always been the case for me. You know, I haven't saved the world, but I've always had a job. I got paid to do that stuff. You know, I always have. And you know, people complain about November because if you stick around the meetings, you hear a lot about gratitude in November. It's the 11th month, 11th step, you know, gratitude, gratitude, gratitude out your ears. I am not grateful enough for being alive, you know, that I am alive, that I survived when virtually every other partner of mine was killed because of the stuff that we did in this country and other countries. I believe there's a reason I'm still alive, just as I believe there's a reason you're sitting in that chair today. You know, I really believe that. My staff drives them crazy because I'll take any intern. You know, they want the good interns. But I really think, I just believe, you know, I'm my daughter, my mother's son. I just believe that anybody can do anything. That's my experience. So I work with people, mentor them. I've got a, you know, a network of people, and as if I needed to forget, I've had hundreds of, you know, birthday wishes today from across the country. I don't deserve it. You know, I absolutely don't. I mean, if being a jerk counted, I don't deserve it. What I can say is this, that I am trying. I try each day to be worthy of this gift that I've been given of sobriety. I am amazed that I have gotten this gift, and yet I have no trouble believing that you deserve it. You know, I go to meetings every day now. When I'm working, I don't, you know. But I do have, in every town that I work in, D.C., you know, in Cambridge, I've got a meeting home group that I go to, and it's always a beginner's meeting because that's what I need to hear always. I work in D.C. all the time, right? I've never gone to the meeting in Congress because I know I'm too much of a star fucker, you know? I would be going only because, hey, I'm going to go to an AA meeting with a congressman kind of shit. For 20 of my 26 years of sobriety while I was working, I made it a point of being anonymous in my work. Because of the Google machine, you can Google me and find out it, but it's funny, the places that I've worked, I made a point of erasing my name and it's not there. And it's kind of strange now for that to see that when I, you know, run into people. But now, you know, that false humility would be false humility. At the time, it was warranted, I believe. I needed to do that. And I've always worked with my sponsor on that particular issue. because I think that's one of the horrible things that happen, particularly to bright people of color in this country. You get picked as the one, right? Like Van Jones, that's the safe black guy that can be there. Or Amy Tan, that's the safe Asian woman. And I hate that. And I was that when I was a kid. But now I think it's important that we stand up. Find your own way. For me, I tell people I'm sober because it's just easier that way. You know, it's just easier. I don't have to keep track of the lies. I still hate answering the phone because to me, that could be, you know, some irate husband because I screwed his wife, because that's who I was. And it's been a long time, decades since I've done that. But that's one of those God shots that helps me remember, you know, who I am, what I can be if I get off the beam here. So that should do it, right?
Yes. Yep.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.